Chapter 7. Stephen was aware of Johnson's motives. They were tolerably obvious for all love, obvious and tolerably clumsy. The man was not an artist, though the avoidance of any hint of material reward was a good stroke, and the mention of Catalonia was better still. What he did not know was just how much certainty Johnson and Dubois possessed. The Catalans might have been no more than a lucky shot in the dark. There had been a good many shots of one kind and another after dinner, sometimes directed towards regions utterly remote from Stephen's battlefield, such as Moscow, Prussia, and Vienna. A great deal would depend on what Johnson had learnt from Jack. Their interview had been present to his mind throughout this afternoon with Diana, sometimes strongly present, sometimes no more than a cold, worrying ghost or shadow far in the background, far behind her words. And now, as he hurried back to the Asclepia, he turned Johnson's account of it over in his mind. A true account, he was sure. No man could have invented the Golden Calf or the Phantom Admiral. The implications of that Admiral Crichton made him feel colder still, and he increased his pace.
"There you are, Stephen," said Jack. "I'm glad to see you. Did they give you a decent dinner? We had a Lenten dish of cod and beans."
"Excellent, I believe. Yes, excellent, with a capital Hermitage. Diana sends you her love."
"Why, that was kind in her, I'm sure. Indeed, we are cousins, after all. And now, since I know where she is, I shall send her all proper acknowledgments for her goodness in writing to Sophie. That is to say, Mr. Johnson came to see me this afternoon. It seems that he is a great man under government in these parts. Choate was quite impressed."
"How did you go along with him?"
"Surprisingly well. I was pretty reserved and distant to begin with, but he explained that the whole business had fallen into the wrong hands in the first place. He had looked into the matter of the brig, the Alice B. Sawyer, and he agreed that since the positions did not coincide, it was nonsense to say that Leopard had brought her to. There had been a foolish mistake somewhere in the department, and he knew the man who would put it right."
"Did he speak of your exchange?"
"Not particularly. He seemed to take it for granted that once the mistake was put right, it would go through in the normal way, and I did not press him. I gathered that he was too great a man to look after the details. No, after we had dealt with the brig, we mostly talked about Nelson. He is a great admirer of Lord Nelson, and the schooner he has down in the Chesapeake, one of those fast American schooners, I take it, that can lie so close to the wind. But even more about you. He thinks the world of Dr. Maturin."
"Does he indeed?"
"Yes. And he said such handsome things about your birds, and your learning, your Latin and Greek, and not to be behindhand, I added your French, like a Frenchman's, and your Spanish and Catalan too, not to mention the outlandish languages you picked up in the East."
"Brother," said Stephen to himself, "you may have dished me with your kindness."
"He lamented that he never could contrive to speak the French," continued Jack, "and so did I, and we puzzled for a while over a paper someone had sent him from Louisiana. Without boasting, I may say that I made out more of it than he did. By the way, what does pong mean?"
Writing it on a piece of paper.
"I believe it means a peacock."
"Not a bridge?"
Stephen shook his head.
"Oh, well, never mind. Let us cross that peacock when we come to it. Then he was curious to know how you came to speak the Catalan, such an out-of-the-way sort of tongue. But knowing that there were some things you would rather keep under hatches, I said to myself, 'Jack,' I said, 'Tacke is the Latin for a candle,' and left him none the wiser. I can be diplomatic when I choose."
Nothing but Jack's diplomacy by land had been wanting to complete the picture. Nothing could more effectually have fixed Johnson's attention on the one point that might determine Dubreuil in his identification. Yet on the other hand, the only Frenchman who knew about Stephen's activities in Catalonia, who knew them at first hand, and who knew him by sight if not by name, could, as dear Jack would put it, tell no tales. All was not lost by any means. He might yet remain Dr. S. Anon, a mere ornithologist.
"Jack," he said, "I'm obliged to you for your good opinion, but in principle, my dear, you might avoid applauding what you are so kind as to call my parts to strangers when we are abroad. It might lead them to think that I was intelligent, even over-intelligent. In our service, on the other hand, you may say whatever you please. The more the better."
"Lord Stephen," cried Jack, "have I done wrong? I was diplomatic, as I say, as deep and mute as—why, anything you like to name.
No, no, I merely threw it out as a general observation. Tell me, what news from the sea today?
Shannon looked into the port after breakfast, as I was telling you when you ran off, and finding President and Congress gone, she sent her consort, probably Tenedos, away into the offing. Then Evans dropped in, bringing one of their officers, Lawrence, who had the Hornet when she sank our Peacock. He has Chesapeake now.
What kind of a man is he? Like Bainbridge?
No, quite a different sort. Much more open and unreserved. Younger, too, about our age. I liked him extremely. But to tell the truth, I liked him much more than Johnson, because although Johnson was so civil about you and a very gentlemanlike creature altogether, there was something I did not really care for. He was not the sort of man I should like to serve with, nor under, whereas I should be happy to ship with Lawrence. He brought a message from young Mowat, taken in Peacock and wounded, but doing well in New York.
They talked of Mowat, a most engaging young man with a literary turn, and Stephen recited some of his verse.
While o'er the ship the gallant boatswain flies, like a horse mastiff through the storm he cries, prompt to direct the unskilful still appears, the expert he praises and the timid cheers. Still through my pulses glides the kindling fire, as lightning glances on the electric wire.
What a memory you have, said Jack. Like a
bull of Bashan?
Just so. Then after that Mr. Harapath very kindly came and sat with me for a while after he had seen his sister. He told me what sad dogs the Republicans were, a little better than mere Democrats, and how he had fought for the king under General Burgoyne. He is a fine old boy, and he has promised to look in tomorrow, bringing me... Here's Shannon, he said, reaching for his telescope. See, she is just clearing the Long Island. Now he will put his helm down to avoid the shoal. There is a nasty shoal just off the point. Harapath pointed it out to me, but by now Broke knows that channel like the palm of his hand. There he rises tacks and sheets. They will all be on tiptoe for the word. Prettily done. She stays in her own length, nimble as a cutter. She is all alone now, with only Chesapeake to watch, Constitution being laid up, so we need not expect to see her throw out any signals.
Why alone? Surely two would keep the Chesapeake in far better than one.
That is the whole point, cried Jack. He don't want to keep her in, of that I'm very sure. He wants her to come out. She cannot be expected to come out against two frigates. That is why he sent Tenedos away the moment he saw that President and Congress was gone. There, she lays her foretopsail to the mast and brails up her driver, makes a sternboard, fills again, and she is round. Prettily done.
Jack kept up a steady commentary on the Shannon's progress as she made her way in through the winding fairway, and while he did so Stephen wondered in himself, what shall I tell him? Jack's physical state was fairly sound, but Stephen did not wish to interrupt his convalescence with any unnecessary agitation of mind. Then there was the long ingrained habit of secrecy, and then again there was the uncertainty with regard to De Broglie. On this occasion was he anything more than a property that Johnson moved onto the stage for his own purposes? As for Johnson, he was reasonably confident of being able to deal with him, although no doubt he was a dangerous man. De Broglie, however, was quite another pair of sleeves, and he had suffered very, very much more from Stephen's activities. He still had not made up his mind by the time the frigate reached the extreme range of the American batteries.
"She lies too," said Jack. "Just so. And there is Philip Broke at the masthead with his glass, staring at the Chesapeake. I was almost sure of him this morning, and now, with the sun in the west, I'm quite certain. Should you like to have a look?"
Stephen aimed the telescope, found the distant figure, and said,
"I can make nothing of him at all, but perhaps you know him well. Can distinguish him at a great distance?"
"Of course I do," said Jack. "Man and boy, I've known Philip Broke these 20 years and more. Surely I must have told you of Philip Broke a score of times."
"Never," said Stephen, "nor have I met the gentleman. I trust he is an able mariner."
"Oh, yes, yes, a capital seaman. To think that I should never have told you about him in all these years. Lord!"
"Pray tell me about him now. There is an hour to go before our supper."
Stephen did not very much wish to know about Captain Broke, but he did want the steady background of Jack's deep, kindly voice, while his mind revolved upon itself, waiting for the sudden flash that would tell him how to act.
"Well," said Jack, "Philip Broke and I are kind of cousins, and when my mother died I was packed off to stay at Broke Hall for a while, a fine old place in Suffolk. Their land runs down to the Orwell, the estuary of the Orwell before it joins the Stour by Harwich, and Philip and I used to spend hours there in the mud, watching the shipping pass up to Ipswich, or fall down with the tide. A lot of those East Country craft, you know, that manage so amazingly well with short tacks in a tricky fairway, and colliers, barges from London River, and Dutchmen from across the way, with their leeboards and fat arses, doggers, chutes, and busses. We were both wild to run away to sea, and we tried once. But old Broke came after us in a dog-cart, took us back, and whipped us till we cried like puppies. He was quite impartial. But still, we did have a misshapen sort of punt of our own, with a lug-sail we were hardly strong enough to hoist. It was the most cross-grained brute that ever swam, and although it was so monstrous heavy, it would overset for a nothing. I used to save Philip's life 3 or 4 times a day, and once I said he should give me a halfpenny for each rescue, but he said no, if I could swim and he could not, it was clear duty as a Christian and a cousin to pull him out, particularly as I was already wet myself. Still, he did say he would pray for me. Oh, those were happy days. You would have liked it, Stephen. There were all sorts of long-legged birds on the mud. We called them toques, and bitterns booming away in the reeds. And those, what do you call them, big white birds with odd-shaped beaks, spoonbills, and the other kind whose bills turn upwards. And there was a dry place on the bank, crammed with ruffs, all fighting one another or pretending to, spreading out their neck feathers like stunsels. And we used to gather plovers' eggs by the bucketful. God knows how long it lasted. But it seemed like a small eternity, and it was always summer. But then he went off to school, and I went off to sea. We wrote 3 or 4 times, which is a good deal for boys. But I'm no great fist at a letter, as you know, and we rather lost touch with one another until I came back from the West Indies when Andromeda paid off. Then I found that he had been unable to bear his school, though he was quick at his book, and had persuaded them to send him to the academy at Portsmouth. Well, of course, I did not like to be seen walking about with an academite.
Were they a very wicked set?
Oh, I dare say they were as wicked as their means allowed, at 12 or 13 or so, but it was not that. They were low. We looked upon them as a miserable crew of sneaking upstart lubbers, learning seamanship and gunnery out of books, and pretending to set themselves on a level with us who had learnt them at sea. Still, we were cousins, so I took him to the Blue Posts and gave him a decent dinner. I had 7 guineas of prize money in my pocket, and he had not a stiver. Old Mr. Broke was generous in big things, but he was precarious near with his halfpence. And we went to the play to see Venice Preserved, and to a raree show where there was Cleopatra's asp, and some fleas that drew a coach, and for 2 pence more the genuine living Venus without a stitch. I offered to treat him, but he said no, it was immoral. Then he joined Bulldog, Captain Hope. He must have been 15 or 16 then, very old to go to sea for the first time. But he was lucky in his captain, a first-rate seaman and a friend of Nelson's. He followed him into Leclerc, and I saw something of him in the Mediterranean. Then he followed him into Romulus, and we were shipmates for a while when I took passage home in her. In those days I could not hold a candle to him in navigation. Mine was all rule of thumb, until I came to love my conic sections quite late in life and to work out the theories for myself. His navigation did not surprise me, because he had always been good at mathematics, as well as hick-hack-hock, but I was amazed to find out how he had come on in seamanship. We both passed for lieutenant at about the same time, but I did not see him again until St. Vincent, when he was 3rd of Southampton, and we waved as we passed, forming the line. After that we did not meet for years, though we heard about one another, of course, from common friends. He was in the Channel most of the while, and the German Ocean, made commander into that rotten old shark, a miserable slug, only good for convoy duty. He was posted well before I was, his father being a great friend of Billy Pitt's. But even so, he could not get a ship, and he was on shore for years and years. He wrote me a very handsome letter after we took the Cacafuego, and he told me he was drilling the peasantry. He had married by that time. Not very well, I'm afraid.
Was the lady unsuitable? So many sailors take the strangest trollops to wife, even drabogues.
No, she was perfectly suitable in that sort of way. A gentlewoman, a connection, and a thumping dowry, too. 10,000, I believe. But she had the vapours. You know, a poor doer, weakly, always in need of repair. But above all, she is always ill-used, always sorry for herself. I knew her as a little girl, and she was sorry for herself then, gasping and turning up her eyes. I'm afraid it weighs upon him. I am sure he would have been better off with a jolly, good-natured wench without a farthing. A woman that takes herself seriously and cannot laugh. Lord, it must weigh on him. I am sure it would weigh on me. I went down to Broke Hall soon after their first boy was born, and I wondered that he could bear it. But he did, just like one of your old Stoics, or a patient on the monument, as they say. Still, he did get afloat as soon as ever he could after the peace, although he had inherited by then a neat estate with some prime farming land and the best partridge shooting in the country. They gave him the dear old Druid, patched, wet, uncomfortable, cramped, and so weak she had to be doubled with fur. But how she could fly! I have absolutely seen her making 14 knots with the wind on her quarter, under t'gallants, 3 reefs out of her topsails, and stunsails aloft and alow. But he never had a chance of distinguishing himself in her. Never met a Frenchman who was his match, which was a pity, because there never was a man who longed for glory more, or who worked harder for it. Even old Jarvie praised the order Druid was kept in, although the Brokes are Tories and always have been. Then they gave him the new Shannon, built at Brindley's yard, to replace the one Leveson Gower ran aground near La Hogue. That was in the year 6, and I went aboard her at the Nore. He was in Ireland at the time, I believe. He had only just commissioned her, and he had not had time to work her up, but she looked promising, and I hear she's in fine trim. Certainly he always had the right ideas about gunnery and discipline. I had not seen him since my visit to Broke Hall, and I found him changed, quieter, rather sad. I'm sure it was his marriage. He always was a religious man, and now he was more so. Not one of your blue-light psalm-singing tract and cocoa captains, and there was no hint of turning the other cheek, or at least not to the king's enemies. You could tell that from his guns. He had fitted them with tangent sights already out of his own pocket, and from the private powder and shot he laid in by the ton. And anyhow, he had a fine reputation for enterprise. No resounding single-ship actions, of course, since they had never come his way, but cutting out expeditions and privateers by the score. But still, there was just a touch of the Puritan. No women aboard, the youngster's grog cut on the first occasion, and no bawdy at his table.
I have known you stop the little boy's grog altogether, and you dislike women aboard, yet you are not a Puritan.
It is true that you talk bawdy with other captains, and that you sing lewd songs when drunk.
Yes, said Jack,
leaving his songs to one side.
But I do it for discipline and good order. Drunken youngsters or midshipmen are a nuisance, and quarrels about women can upset a whole ship's company, besides emptying their pockets so that they sell their slops and steal the ship's furniture, and ruining their health so that they cannot lay aloft or train a gun. Broke does it on moral grounds. He hates drunkenness in itself, and he hates adultery and fornication, because they are all three of them sins not against the ship, but against God. When I say women, by the way, I mean common women, the hordes that put off in boats when a ship comes in.
This I have never seen.
Jack smiled. There was a good deal in the Navy that Stephen had never seen.
No, I do not suppose you have, since you have only sailed with me, and I will not have it in ships I command. But surely you must have noticed the swarms of boats, the hordes of brutes round any man of war in port.
I had supposed they were visitors.
Some of them are, the men's wives and families, or sweethearts. But most of them are whores, 200 or 300 whores at a time, sometimes more whores than men, and they lie with the watch below, doubling up in every hammock, sharing their victuals and taking their money until the ship goes to sea again. It is a surprising sight, all that busy copulation, for there is never a screen, as you know, and not very pleasant for the married man's real wives and children. Most captains allow it, so long as the women are searched for spirits. They say it is good for the hands, and a good many of the officers and mids take girls in, too. When I was a boy, I remember the gunroom and the midshipman's berth in the old Rezzo was full of them whenever we put in, and you were thought a miserable scrub and a holier-than-thou killjoy if you did not have your whack. It opens a youngster's eyes, I can tell you.
Supper came. A single dish of cod. And Moria said,
"Why, doctor, sir, I thought you were in your room. I was going to take your tray in there. Did the gentleman find you so?"
"What gentleman was that, my dear?"
"The foreign gentleman I told to go up. I was so busy with the pots. Sure he's sitting there yet, the creature."
"I will go and see," said Stephen.
The gentleman was not sitting there yet, but he had improved his time by going through Stephen's papers. It had been well done, barely discernible to an unsuspicious eye, except that the gentleman's professional skill did not extend to remaking a bed with the precision of a pair of nurses, and where he had searched under the mattress there was an unsightly bulge. But in any case, Stephen's was a suspicious eye.
It caught the unnatural neatness of the medical notes on his table and the rearrangement of his borrowed books. "Jack," he said, when they had eaten up their cod, "things are not quite as I could wish. At one time, they suspected you of being concerned with intelligence. Now they suspect me. I do not believe the Americans will act without proofs, and there are no proofs. But there are French agents in America. One has just searched my room, and with them it is different. It is not impossible that the situation may turn ugly."
"But surely they cannot do anything to you in the United States. This is not Spain."
"Perhaps not. Still and all, I have a suspicion they might try, and I mean to take my precautions. When Mr. Herapath comes tomorrow, please to give him this note. When he has read it, take it back and put it in the fire. It tells him I feel that further meetings between him and myself would be inopportune at this moment, and it begs him to procure us a pair of pocket pistols. Do you think he will do so, Jack?"
"Yes," said Jack, "I believe so. If only I may mention the Frenchman. He hates the French as much as I do."
"Just touch upon them, then. A diplomatic hint, no more." Herapath was not Johnson, not by a very long way indeed. "I have already desired the porter to admit no man he does not know, and I have borrowed this from Mr. Choate's instrument cabinet." He unwrapped his handkerchief and showed a catling with a heavy handle and a short double-edged blade. "We use these for amputations," he observed.
"It looks precious small," said Jack.
"Bless you, Jack. An inch of steel in the right place will do wonders. Man is a pitiably frail machine," said Stephen, looking attentively into Jack's face. Perhaps he had been wrong to speak. The fever seemed to be returning. "And many a one has been killed by a lancet, no more, though not always on purpose. But you are not to take what I have said as anything but a statement of suspicion. We have to take measures even against great improbabilities, and a pair of pocket pistols will always come in." The suspicion, vivid throughout the night and morning, strengthened exceedingly as Stephen was walking through the little town to keep his rendezvous with Johnson. Coming towards him on the other side of the busy main street, he saw Louisa Wogan. His eye was attracted to her by the men's heads turning on her passage, and he observed that two of her admirers were captured Royal Navy lieutenants, pleasantly named Abel and Kane. She caught sight of him a moment later, gave him a queer look, difficult to interpret, though concern, fright, and enmity were there, and darted into the nearest shop, a tobacconist's.
"Thank you, my dear," said Stephen.
He kissed his hand to her and walked on, following the sailors at some 30 yards. He noticed how gaily they twirled their canes and saluted their acquaintance. Carriages of one kind and another were picking up and setting down outside Franchon's hotel, or merely waiting, and from one of these, a little before he drew abreast of it, leapt Pontécanet, glaring about with a wild look upon his face, and calling for a doctor. Seeing Stephen, he ran to him, crying,
"Quick, Dr. Maturin! The dame is in a fit, here in the coach! Blood, blood!"
He took him by the arm, urging him towards the open door. Two other men jumped out. Two more came from the hotel porch. They were round him, pressing close, and all the time Pontécanet kept crying,
"Hurry! Oh, come at once! Hurry! Hurry!"
Quick, low French muttered words.
"The other arm! Club him quick! Get his neck! Fling him in!"
Stephen lunged back with all his force and threw himself to the ground, roaring and bawling,
"Stop thief! Stop thief! Pickpockets! Cain and Abel! A rescue! A rescue!"
Making an infernal noise, lashing about, grasping arms and legs. He brought one man down and bit him till he screamed. They heaved him bodily up, but by now it was too late. There was shouting all around, a crowd, Cain and Abel plying their sticks, and without a pause he kept up his
"Stop thief! Pickpockets!"
Pontécanet's English deserted him. His
"Him, robber!"
carried no conviction. The crowd was turning nasty. The Frenchmen crammed themselves into the coach with extraordinary speed, and it thundered off, followed by angry shouts.
"Are you hurt, sir?"
asked Abel, helping him to his feet.
"Did they rob you, sir?"
asked Cain, dusting him.
"All is well, I thank you," said Stephen. "Please to lend me a pin. Those ruffians tore my coat."
"I am glad I broke my stick over the fat one's head," said Cain.
"How pleasant to see you," said Johnson, when Stephen was shown in.
Stephen was pale and trembling with anger still, but his mind was sharp and clear. He would play his hand as an outraged citizen.
"Mr. Johnson, sir," he cried, "I wish to register an official complaint of the utmost gravity. I have just been set upon in the street, in front of this hotel, in front of your hotel, sir, by a band of ruffians, Frenchmen, led by Pont des Canets. They attempted to abduct me, to force me into a coach. I shall register the same complaint with the British agent for prisoners of war first thing tomorrow morning. I demand the protection of your country's laws and the common security of person universally afforded to captured officers. I demand that Pont des Canets be brought to trial and his followers identified and punished, and as soon as I have seen the agent, he will make the same demand at the highest official level."
Johnson was infinitely concerned. He begged Dr. Maturin to lie on the couch, to take a little brandy, or at least a glass of water. He regretted the incident extremely, and he should certainly make the strongest representations to the Frenchman's chief. Still playing the part of one who has received an outraged citizen's complaint, he then spoke in general terms for some considerable time, saying nothing with the practised ease of a politician. The iniquity of such proceedings to be deplored, the dreadful consequences of war, the desirability of peace, of a just and lasting peace. Stephen watched him as he spoke, and although he could control his impatience at the meaningless flow and his anger at the blundering attack, he was not so much the master of his eyes. Their pale, unwinking, somewhat reptilian examination made Johnson nervous. It put him off his stroke. He brought his discourse to a lame conclusion, stood up, took a turn or two about the room, opened the window, and called out to the workmen on the balcony to make less din, and then, recovering his poise, he went on in quite a different tone. Speaking confidentially, as man to man, he asked Dr. Maturin to consider the difficulty of his position. He was only a small cog in a very large machine, and if, in wartime, those above thought fit to give French agents a greater degree of liberty, a freer hand than he, for his part, thought congruent with the national sovereignty, he could do nothing more than protest. And the reply would no doubt be that it was done for the sake of reciprocity, that American agents in the territories governed by the French were tacitly allowed an equal freedom.
"On the other hand," he said, "I can most certainly protect my own agents. Of that you may be absolutely confident. So I do beg that for your sake you will allow me to enroll you as a consultant."
"What is it?"
he cried, in answer to a knock.
"The carriage is at the door, sir," said a servant, "and Mr. Michael Herapath is still waiting."
"I cannot see him now," said Johnson,
going to his desk and taking a sheaf of galley proofs.
"Give him these and say I hope to see him the day after tomorrow. No, stay. I shall give them to him myself on the way out."
The door closed, and he went on,
"To enroll you as a consultant, say on Catalan affairs. The barest minimum, a slight aid memoir on the situation there, the historical background would suffice. Just enough to satisfy Mr. Secretary's conscience. I will not press you now. You are disturbed, and I dare say very angry, but I do beg you to give it the most earnest consideration, and to let me have your response on my return the day after tomorrow. Until then, I guarantee there will be no repetition of this morning's incident. And now, if I may, I will call a carriage for you. Though, now I come to think of it, there is Herapath downstairs, if you prefer to go back with him. You certainly should not walk home alone after such unpleasantness."
Unless Michael Herapath was a perfect monster of duplicity, he was entirely ignorant of the whole affair, and Stephen had known the young man long enough and well enough to be sure that he was no monster of any kind, except perhaps of erudition. As they walked along, he talked eagerly of his father's changed attitude towards the medical school, which he believed he owed to Dr. Maturin's great kindness, and of his future studies. And he talked even more eagerly of his book, showed sample sheets, admired the print, gazed with loving eyes upon the title page, and standing in the busy throng, he read some passages aloud.
"Here is a version, my dear sir," he said, "that I flatter myself you will not wholly disapprove.
Flower. Is it a flower?
Mist.
Is it a mist?
Coming at midnight, leaving with the dawn. She is there. The sweetness of a passing springtime. She is gone. The morning haze, no trace at all."
Stephen listened gravely and applauded. He said,
"That may sum up the usual relationship between the sexes. Each tends to worship a being of its own creation. Women often expect oranges to grow on apple trees, and men look for constancy to a purely imaginary ideal. How often a woman proves to be no more than the morning mist."
And slowly he edged Herapath along, sometimes as much as 100 yards between the poems. In a decent interval he asked after Caroline, who was very well apart from a slight rash, and after Mrs. Wogan, who was somewhat out of sorts, mumpish and off her food. But she would soon be cured by a sight of these proofs. Speaking as one medical man to another, Herapath offered a physical explanation for this state of mind and body, and going on from this they fell to discussing the books he should read.
"But more than any book," said Stephen, "I do most earnestly recommend A Private Corpse. Your school cadaver, tossed about in wanton play, your odd heads and parts indifferently pickled by the porter's wife, are well enough for the coarse processes, but for the fine work give me a good fresh private corpse, preferably a pauper, to avoid the fat, lovingly preserved in the best spirits of wine, double refined. Here are eloquent volumes, Nocturna Versate Mano, Versate Diurna, with a whole library of mere print. There is your father on the other side of the road. I'm sure he will help you to a corpse. He is a worthy man. Do you not perceive your father, Mr. Herapath?"
They were approaching the Asclepia, and from it came the old gentleman carrying a basket. But Michael Herapath was in such a pleasurable flutter of spirits with his book that he did not make him out until, in reply to Stephen's salute, he returned a distant bow. At the same time he shot Stephen a significant look, raised his finger to his lips, and although he did not actually do so, gave the impression of walking on the tips of his toes, a general impression of knowing stealth.
"He's carrying a basket," observed his son. "I dare say he's been taking Aunt Putnam soft-shelled crabs." "Should you not relieve him of his burden?" said Stephen. "Enlightened self-interest, no less than filial piety, demands such a course. Good day to you now, and I thank you for your company."
"Jack," he said, "how do you do?"
"Prime, prime. But what's this, Stephen? Have you been in a mill?"
"Pontécanet tried to force me into a coach. Cain and Abel came to my rescue. It amounted to nothing. Tell me, how did Mr. Herapath respond to my request?"
"Are you really quite well, Stephen? No injury?"
"Quite well, I thank you. My coat is torn, but I have arranged it with a pin. What said friend Herapath?"
"He spoke up like a friend, like a good'un. Damned the French and all their works, stepped out directly and came back with these in a basket."
Jack leaned over and brought up a case of pistols with their fittings.
"There, London made, Joe Manton's best. As pretty a pair as he could wish. I've been playing with them this last half hour, getting the flints just so. Will you give me your coat?" he said, leaning over again for his hussif. "It is only the sewing of the pocket."
"I admire the way you sailors sew," said Stephen, watching him.
"A pretty set of scarecrows we should look if we were to wait for women to do it for us," said Jack, stitching away. "As a youngster I was in Goliath when she wore Admiral Harvey's flag, blue at the main, and we were expected to be uncommon trim. Hessian boots, white breeches, laced hats, black stocks, and anyone who did not pass the Admiral's inspection was put on watch and watch. Only 4 hours' sleep at a time comes very hard when you're a boy, so we plied our needles and our blacking balls. But where I really learnt to sew was in Resolution, when Captain Douglas turned me before the mast, as I believe I told you."
"I remember it. You were made a common sailor for a while to cure you of lechery. A strange notion, from what you tell me of women on the lower deck. But perhaps it had an effect?"
"It had the effect of enabling me to make myself a suit of hot-weather slops. I will not say to mend a friend's coat, for that might be ungenerous. We were given so many yards of duck, and we were set to in our watch below. They were not your common purser's slops, neither, because we were a dressy ship. Half the crew were dandy kiddies. And we topmen of the starboard watch sewed blue ribbons into our seams for church and divisions. And then I was sailmaker's crew as well, and that taught me a gallows sight more, including the use of my left hand, as you see. Tell me, Stephen," he went on in quite a different tone, "how do you see the situation at present, and what do you think we should do?"
"The situation now? Well, I believe the French have smoked me. You know that in my line I have done them all the harm I could, and I think they will kill me for it if ever they can. On the other hand, I think Johnson can protect me."
"Because of your friendship with Diana?
Not at all. I believe he knows nothing of its real nature. Mere long acquaintance, no more, for him. And it would not answer if he did. They are not well together. She hates him as a man and as an enemy. Diana is very patriotic, Jack. She feels our reverses most bitterly.
Of course she does, said Jack in a sombre voice. So must anyone who has a scrap of pride.
She wishes to leave him and to leave America. I have proposed that she should marry me, recover her nationality, and return with us when we are exchanged. If Johnson knew this, he would either provoke me, since he is a very jealous man, and one who wishes to keep what I might describe as a harem. They are great duelers in the southern states, and he has been out many a times, or he would throw me to the French.
Jack thought it better to make no remark on Stephen's offer of marriage, though his consternation was plain enough to a perceptive eye. He said,
He would protect you, then, out of liking, and because it is the right and proper thing to do?
He would not. He is an important man in American intelligence, and his liking would not weigh a feather. No, he believes that he may get some information out of me, and if I do not mistake, he supposed that from a little I may be led, by various forms of pressure, to give more, and then more, until at last he has turned me entirely. It is a common practice. I have often known it succeed. But I do not intend to be a party even to the first stages of the process. He has given me until Monday to make up my mind, and I mean to make use of that time. It appears to me that our safety lies in noise. I shall see our agent for prisoners of war. I shall speak to all our acquaintance, prisoners or otherwise, to all the foreign consuls in this town, perhaps to the civil authorities and the Federalist newspaper editors. Covert operations of this kind must be carried out in silence. Noise is death to secret intelligence, above all in a town like this, with an active, vocal public opinion, much of it strongly opposed to the war. And I mean to make all the public noise I can, just as I lay down in the street and bellowed and hallooed until a crowd gathered when Pontécanet set upon me. I believe it will answer in this case, too, and that the shadowy charges against you having been abandoned, the exchange will take place in the usual way. That is how I shall spend tomorrow, and what there is of Monday.
I hope to God you're right, said Jack.
But what about the bloody-minded Frenchmen in the meantime?
Johnson has given me assurances that they will not move before our next meeting. They are not in their own country, after all. He holds them over my head as a threat, you see, to compel me to acquiesce. It is reasonable to rely on his assurance, since he is not going to sacrifice a potentially valuable agent for the sake of gratifying Dubreuil's lust for revenge. It is in his interest to preserve me until our final interview on Monday, and after that we can sit here, never stirring out, protected by the public noise I shall have raised. And if, by any most unlikely chance, the French should make an attempt upon me here, we can now defend ourselves.
Jack cut the thread and handed back the mended coat. He looked out of the window where the Shannon's topsails winked in the evening light and said,
Dear Lord above, how I do wish I could set you clear of all this dirty, ugly, underhanded mess. How I long for the open sea.
The dawn of Sunday did not break at all. The fog that had formed in the night only became a little lighter and more visible as it moved in quiet swathes along the quays, sometimes making silent whirlpools at the street corners where it met a current of air. The slight increase in light was not enough to wake Dr. Maturin, however, and the two nurses with whom he had contracted to go to early mass were obliged to beat on his door to rouse him. He hurried into his clothes, but even so the priest was on the altar by the time they reached the obscure chapel in a side alley and crept into the immensely evocative smell of old incense. There followed an interval on a completely different plane of being, with the familiar ancient words around him always the same, in whatever country he had ever been, though now uttered in a broad Munster Latin. He lived free of time or geography, and he might have walked out, a boy, into the streets of Barcelona, blazing white in the sun, or into those of Dublin under the soft rain. He prayed, as he had prayed so long for Diana. But even before the priest dismissed them, the changed nature of his inner words brought him back to the immediate present and to Boston, and if he had been a weeping man, it would have brought the tears coursing down his face. As it was, he felt a dry burning in his eyes, a constriction in his throat, while he waited for the priest to come out of the vestry. To him he stated that he was a prisoner of war, that he was likely to be exchanged in the next few days, that he wished to be married before his voyage, and that as soon as he could he would acquaint Father Costello with the day and hour, because the ceremony would have to be carried out with very little notice. Then he left the misty, candle-lit chapel for the colder fog outside, and considered for a while. It would be no use calling on Diana at this time of the morning, since she often lay abed till noon. But there were many other things to do. Perhaps the first should be to see Mr. Andrews, the British agent for prisoners of war. Stephen knew where he lived, and taking his bearings from the vague form of a clock tower, he set out. He had a fair knowledge of the town, and he was confident that presently he should cross the street with Franchon's hotel in it. The agent's house lay not far from the hotel, a couple of hundred yards behind it. But the broad street did not appear. Instead he found himself at the harbour, with a far broader sea at his feet, stretching away into the greyness. High water, and scarcely a ripple. The wet quays were empty. Drops fell from the yards and rigging of the ships tied up along them. No sound but the clopping of a few horses' hooves, and the distant plash of oars, as those few Bostonians who celebrated the Sabbath on Saturday, or who did not celebrate it at all, rowed out to go fishing. On ordinary days there were a good many of these small craft. The Shannon never troubled them at all, but had been seen purchasing their lobsters, pollock, hake, and halibut in baskets. At last he found a negro on the waterfront, but the negro was a stranger in those parts, and together they wandered in search of the street that ran down and opened onto the harbour itself. No street, only vile cobbles, puddles, dark warehouses, and the encircling fog, and at one point Stephen thought they must soon reach the open country. But in time a light appeared, a row of lighted windows. "Let us knock," he said, "and ask our way. We may be out of the town entirely." Yet before he had had time to knock, he found he knew the place. Although the fog removed it from its context and altered its perspective, it was the tavern where he had met Mr. Hedipath and his friends. The place was open, and as he pushed the door, a rectangular flood of orange light lit up the fog. "Come in and drink a cup of coffee, friend," he said to his companion.
"But I am a negro, sir."
"A black man," said he.
"That is no very heinous crime."
"Oh, brother, you sure are a stranger here," said the negro, laughing. And he vanished into the fog, laughing still. When Stephen came out, wiping his lips, it had thinned somewhat, and at times the red ball of the sun could be seen. The geography, at least, was plain. He walked briskly along to what he privately called the Rambler, and up it to the hotel. There was some activity within, but as far as he could make out, Diana's windows were blind. No lights behind the balcony along the whole first floor. From the hotel he took first one side street, where a disoriented cock was crowing, then another, peopled by ghostly hogs, and not by hogs alone. He passed a couple of men lounging in a doorway, and an interminable family carrying prayer books, and as he drew near to Mr. Andrews's house, he saw a vague, dark shape that very soon resolved itself into a coach, four horses stretching out before it, gently steaming through their cloths. A black coach. Pontécanet's coach. No light in Andrews's windows, none in the fanlight of his door. Deliberately he began to cross the road, but a head at the coach window cried, "Le voilà!" The doors opened, and men poured out. Stephen whipped round and raced back. A hog across his path very nearly brought him down, and as he recovered, he heard a whistle blown behind him and saw the two men leave their doorway. They ran to close the two side alleys, and both had their pistols out. The numerous family lay between him and them. Did they amount to a crowd? A group numerous enough? They did not. Stephen was among them, the woman's outraged face turning towards him as he jostled her tallest boys, but even so the man on the left levelled his piece and fired, hitting a child just by him. After an infinitesimal pause of stupor, the man of the family went for him like a tiger with his stick, and Stephen ran left-handed past the fighting pair. The streaming hogs, the screaming children delayed the man on the right and those from the coach. Stephen had a clear start, but he also had a shocking stitch in his side. As he laboured on, he looked right and left for a lighted house, a church, a tavern, and looked in vain, for this was a commercial district, gaunt warehouses with cranes protruding from their upper stories, closed offices, shut-up shops, and the running feet were louder and louder behind. A weed-grown vacant lot, an improvised pigsty within it, he slipped through the ragged palings and crouched there with a gravid sow near her time, timid and new-littered for her farrowing. Bent double to overcome the stitch, he stared round for the dwelling of the man who had brought the straw. No cottage, no dwelling house at all, only stark walls soaring up on all three sides, and no way out. In a few moments, when they missed him ahead, his refuge would become a hopeless trap, and the fog was growing patchy as a small breeze wafted it to and fro. The stitch was gone. He moved to the paling, but already here were two men running back. He shrank down among the nettles, his pistol in his hand, a very wicked look on his face. They passed. He slipped out and ran directly after them, going free and fine, a bounding step. He passed a barefoot, staring boy. The corner could not be far. But there were running steps, a single man behind, and though now he ran at his greatest speed, even at the risk of overtaking those in front, the steps ran faster still. Closer, closer, and he could hear the panting breath. He could feel the pointing pistol. Closer still, and the man was abreast, an Indian, a half-caste glancing sideways, a questioning dark face he had never seen, and here was the corner showing through the fog.
"Veet! Veet!" cried Stephen in a gasping croak. "A gauche! Tu l'attraperas!"
The man nodded, sped on, turned the corner at a shocking speed. The fog swallowed him. Stephen bore right and left, and here was the coach again. Still no light in Andrews's house, and cries behind him and in front, for one group had made the whole circuit. The coach doors still hung open, not a man there, but the driver, dim in his box. Calling out,
"Allez, allez!"
Stephen ran to the coach, slammed the near door, sprang onto the box, clapped his cocked pistol to the coachman's head, and said,
"Fuit!"
The coachman changed colour, gathered his reins, cried,
"Ré!"
and cracked his whip. The horses lunged forward. The coach moved off, faster, faster and faster.
"Fuit! Fuit!" said Stephen,
and the coachman plied his whip. The first group of men, tall Pontécanet with him, appeared ahead, stringing out across the road as they grasped the situation.
"Fuit toujours!"
said Stephen, grinding the pistol into the coachman's neck. They drove straight through the line, and here was the side road that led to the broad main street.
"À gauche! À gauche, je te dis!"
The coachman reined in to take the corner. The pursuers gained. The coach was round, rocking wildly on its springs. The broad street was just ahead.
"À droite!"
said Stephen, for the right-hand turn would take them fast away, galloping down the good road to the harbour. The coachman half stood to heave upon the reins and swing his horses round. The pistol shifted as Stephen braced himself for the turn, and with a furious heave of his loins, the coachman jerked him off. He was up like a cat before the coachman could stop his team, before Pontécanet and his men were more than a vague, dark mass coming towards him. He ran up the street, away from the coach, but he could not run much more. His head had hit the curb and his feet were straying wild. And there was shouting in the fog ahead. Here was Franchon's hotel, and here, better than any public door with a Frenchman so hot for blood, was the workmen's rope, dangling from the balcony. Hand over hand he went up it, and not indeed like a topman laying aloft, but like a lithe, dangerous, wild beast, trying one last ruse before turning on its equally dangerous and more numerous enemies. The balcony railing, and he was over, crouching there with his breath coming in enormous gasps, his heart beating as though it filled his breast, his eyes unable to focus clear. He heard French voices below arguing about the way to take.
"He may have gone in here!"
It would not be long before they saw the rope. His breath was coming easier now, and he could see. He crept fast and low along the balcony, counting the windows to Diana's room. Hers was closed and shuttered too. He rapped. No reply. He whipped out his catling, slid the blade into the crack and raised the bar, opened the shutter, tapped on the glass. A voice below.
"I shall climb it."
"Diana!"
he called, and he saw her sit up in bed.
"Quick! For the love of God!"
The rope was creaking behind him now.
"Who is it? Don't be a fool, woman!"
he called, low but sharp, through the small gap he had forced in the frame. A broken pane would be sheer disaster.
"Open, quick,
dear Christ and all!
She sprang up, opened the long window. He slid the shutter to without a sound, closed the window behind him, drew the curtain, and leapt into her bed. A huge bed, and he at the bottom of it.
Get in on top of me,
he whispered through the sheets.
Ruffle the clothes upon its foot.
She sat there rigid, her toes warm upon his neck. Quiet footsteps on the balcony.
No, that is Johnson's woman's room. Try the next but two.
A long, silent pause, and at last a knock on the door. Madame Franchon's voice. She was extremely sorry to disturb Mrs. Villiers, but it was thought that a thief had taken refuge in the hotel. Had Mrs. Villiers heard or seen anything? No, said Diana, nothing at all. Might Madame Franchon look at the inner rooms? Mrs. Villiers had the keys.
Certainly, said Diana. Wait a moment.
She slipped out of bed, threw some gauzy things over it, opened the door, and returned to the deep, rumpled nest of eiderdown and countless pillows.
The keys are on the table there, she said.
It took Madame Franchon only a few minutes to decide that the inner rooms, with their closed, unbroken windows and their unviolated doors, contained no flying thief, but in that time Stephen thought he must die of cramp and suffocation. The worst was the flood of apologies, and he felt an infinite relief when Diana cut them short, closed the door on Madame Franchon, and shot the bolt. He came out into the air, and gradually the drumming in his ears died away.
You should have a drink, Maturin,
she whispered, reaching for a pretty little decanter by her bed.
You don't mind drinking out of my glass?
She poured him a stiff tot, and mechanically he drank it off. The fire spread in his vitals. He recognized the smell, the same smell that mingled with Diana's usual scent there in the bed.
Is it a kind of whiskey?
He asked.
They call it bourbon, she said. Another drop?
Stephen shook his head.
Is your maid here? The tall one, Peg. Send her away, right away, until tomorrow.
Diana went into another room. He heard the distant ringing of a bell, and then Diana's voice, telling Peg to take Abijah and Sam to Mr. Adams's house in the dog cart, and to give him this note. There seemed to be some low, murmuring objection, for Diana's voice rose to a sharp, imperious tone, and the door closed with a decided clap. She came back and sat on the side of the bed.
That's done, she said. I have sent them all off until Monday morning.
She looked at him affectionately, hesitated, poured herself a finger of bourbon, and said,
What are you at, Maturin? Flying from an angry husband? It is not like you to bound from one bed to another. Yet after all you are a man. You spoke to me from the other side of the window just like a man, just as though we were already married. You called me a fool. But perhaps I am a fool. I was truly desolated hearing you with Johnson yesterday, and not seeing you after all. My God, Stephen, I was so glad to hear your voice just now. I thought you had deserted me.
He turned his face to her, and her smile faded.
He said, I was escaping from Pontécanet and his band. They mean to kill me if they can. They waylaid me in the street yesterday. That was what I was speaking to Johnson about, and they made a far more determined attempt just now. Listen, honey, will you dress at once and go to the British agent? Tell him I am beset and cannot stir from here. Pontécanet and Dubreuil live in this hotel, do they not?
Yes.
Any others?
No, but all the Frenchmen, officers and civilians haunt the place. There are always half a dozen of them in the hall.
Sure, I saw them myself. Now Andrews may not be in Boston on a Sunday. There was no light in his house this morning, but he has a cottage by the sea somewhere this side of Salem. Herapath knows it. He has been there. Could you see Herapath without Wogan?
Very easily. Louisa is in the country with Johnson.
Ah, then if Andrews is not here, take Herapath with you to the cottage. Tell Andrews that if he can gather a party of our officers to cover us, all will be well. Dubois will never risk the flaring public scandal of an attack on the Asclepia, and by tomorrow I shall have raised such a noise that private murder will be out of the question. Call a chaise and wear a veil. There is no danger, but it would be as well for you not to be seen. Is there any likelihood of the people of the hotel coming to clean the room?
No. Johnson always insists upon his own house slaves doing everything. But if you like, you could go into his rooms. They do not open onto the corridor, and we have the only keys, there on the table.
She bent down, kissed him, and hurried out of the room.
He heard her order the carriage. Was it more than 2 posts to Salem? And in less time than he had ever known a woman take to dress, she was back in a travelling habit and a broad-brimmed, veiled hat. They embraced. He said,
"I never doubted your courage, my dear. Tell the man to drive slow in this wicked fog. God bless."
She said, "I will lock you in." And she was gone. He walked into the big drawing-room next door, unshuttered and by contrast fairly light. The fog had thinned a little more, and standing on a chair he could see the dim form of her chaise move out into the roadway, turn to the right and right again, down the side street he had so lately traversed, towards Mr. Andrews's house. If he were there, she would be back in 20 minutes. If not, then in perhaps 2 hours or 3. She had all the spirit in the world, all the courage for this kind of thing, for a physical emergency. Guts, as the seaman said. It was impossible not to admire her. Impossible not to like her. A French clock on the mantelshelf struck 11. Twice. He sat down, and while deep within himself he went on musing about Diana, his medical side, his medical hands moved about his painful ribs, his far more painful head. He felt curiously exhausted, and his mind did not focus well but moved vaguely round and round the central point. The physician was in better shape, stating that the 8th and 9th ribs were probably cracked, no more, but that there was something very like a crepitation along the coronal suture, a little above the temporal crest, while the main seat of pain was on the other side, a clear contre-coup effect.
"I wonder that there was no concussion," he observed, "but no doubt nausea will ensue."
This was all the physician had to say, since there was no remedy but rest, and Stephen's thoughts returned wholly to Diana. A glance at the clock showed him that she must by now have got on to the Andrews's cottage, and he pictured her haranguing the anxious, worried little man. The half-hour roused him to a sense of his duty. He returned to the bedroom, picked up the keys, and passed through the long suite of rooms to Johnson's private quarters, unlocking and relocking the doors as he went. The last true room was evidently his closet, with a large roll-top desk, a strong-box, and a quantity of files and papers. A door in the far corner led to a privy, which also contained a hip bath. It was just as well, because at this point the nausea that he had foreseen came on, and he knelt there, vomiting for a while. Recovered now, and washed, he walked back into the study. The difficulty was to know where to start. On the scientist's principle of dealing with the easiest first, he went through the open files and papers. Most were the private records and accounts of a very wealthy man, but there were some interesting French documents with translations in Diana's dashing hand. These dated back to before the war. The more recent were in hands he did not recognize, except for Louisa Wogan's. Even so, Diana would possess useful knowledge about the background of the French connection. Memoranda about the military position on the Great Lakes and the Canadian land frontier. A coded list, presumably of agents there. A note about himself. Pontet-Canet confirms that Mathurin has an inclination to retire to the States. A grant of land in a district of unusual interest to a naturalist might swing the scale. More accounts and official correspondence. Lists of prisoners with remarks and interrogations, nothing of the first importance but useful material among the dross. He turned his attention to the desk. None of the keys fitted it, which was significant, but roll-top desks in general presented no great difficulty to one who was used to these things, and once Stephen had found which of the ornamental knobs controlled the back bar, one firm thrust of his catling released the bolt and the top rolled back. The first thing he saw was the blaze of Diana's Riviere in its open case, blazing even in this pale, ghostly light, and beside it, under the heavy obsidian phallus that acted as a paperweight, a letter addressed to himself. The seal had been raised, and he was not the first to read.
"Dearest Stephen, I heard you talking, and I expected you, but I saw you go away without coming to me. Oh, what can it mean? Have I vexed you? I did not give you a clear answer. We were interrupted, and perhaps you thought I refused your offer. But I did not, Stephen. I will marry you whenever you wish, and oh, so gladly. You do me too much honour, Stephen, dear. I should never have refused you in India. It went against my heart.
But now, such as I am, alas, I am entirely yours, Diana. P.S. That gross fellow is taking his trollop into the country. Come and see me. We shall have all Sunday together. Remember me to Cousin Jack.
He had barely grasped the full implication of this before he heard a sound at the door, a slight metallic grating at the lock. It was certainly not Diana. He seized the paperweight, silently closed the desk, and stepped behind the opening door. It was Ponte Cane, on the same errand as himself. The Frenchman obviously knew the place, and he was better equipped than Stephen. He selected one of the many skeleton keys on his ring and opened the strongbox, took out a book, and carried it to the desk. His practiced hand went straight to the master knob, the top rolled back, and he sat down to copy from the book. He moved the diamond necklace to make room for the paper he brought from his pocket, and in doing so he saw the letter.
"Oh, oh, la garce!" he whispered as he read it. "Oh, la garce!"
Stephen had his pistol ready, but although this was an inside room, enclosed, he wished to avoid the noise. Ponte Cane stiffened, uneasy, raising his head as though he felt the threat. Stephen strode forward, and as the Frenchman turned, he brought the massive obsidian down on his head, breaking both. Ponte Cane was on the floor, limp but breathing. Stephen bent over him, catling in hand, felt for the still-beating common carotid, severed it, and stood back from the jet of blood. Then he pulled the body to the hip bath, placed towels and mats to prevent the blood soaking through to the floor below, and went through the dead man's pockets. Nothing of significance, but he did take Ponte Cane's pistol, and since he did not possess one, his watch, a handsome Breguet, very like that which had been taken from him years ago, when he was captured by the French off the coast of Spain. Changing the bloody chair for another, he sat down to the open book. Memoranda of Johnson's conversations with Dubois, copies of his letters to his political chief, day-by-day transactions, future projects, uncoded, perfectly frank. No wonder Ponte Cane had gone straight to it. With this book before him, he had his ally's secret mind wide open, without the last reserve. On the most recent page, after a complaint about the Frenchman's attack on Dr. Maturin, Johnson had written, "I shall have a further interview with him on Monday, when I propose to bring greater pressure to bear. If, however, he should still prove obdurate, I believe he must be discreetly resigned to Dubrois in exchange for a free hand with Lambert and Brown, preferably in a place where this will excite no public comment. I have already repatriated virtually all the fit prisoners to prevent any unpleasant incident." Had Johnson written this before or after he had read Diana's letter? If before, had he then given Dubrois leave to go ahead? Or had the Frenchman, fearing that Stephen would yield on Monday, decided to confront Johnson with a fait accompli once again? They were interesting points, but purely academic at this stage. He returned to the study of the book. It was easier to read now, the midday sun having partially dispersed the fog, and with the greater light the town had woken up. The noise of traffic in the street had reached something near its usual pitch, and someone at no great distance was letting off fireworks. Was this perhaps a holiday? Another American victory at sea? The pain in his head was growing, and in spite of the greater light his eyes would not keep their focus long. Lost in his reading, and his conjectures, and his pain, he did not perceive the opening of the door that Ponte Cane had left unlocked until it was already on the jar.
"Tu es là, Jean-Paul?" whispered Dubrois.
No choice this time. No question of silence now. Stephen rose, whipping round with a pistol already in his hand, thrust it against Dubrois' recoiling chest and fired. The man jerked back against the edge of the open door, and as it slowly yielded, so he fell. The expression of amazement and malignity lasting until his head was quite down, dull and indifferent at last. Stephen stood with a smoking pistol in his hand, listening to the immense report that seemed to fill the room and his head so lastingly. The smell of powder and scorched cloth. Slow, slow. The minutes passed. Yet no one seemed to have heard the shot. No running feet, no hammering on the outer doors, no sound at all but for the clock striking the quarter, and outside some kind of a procession was passing the hotel, remote cheers, laughter, a squib or two. The tension diminished to a tolerable pitch. He put the pistol down and dragged Dubreuil to the privy, to the hip bath.
"This is like the end of Titus Andronicus," he said, with an affectation of callous brutality, as he heaved the body in.
But he was, he found, seriously disturbed, and he wondered why. He had not even searched Dubreuil. Why not? Corpses he had seen by the score, even by the hundred, in open and clandestine battle, yet this killing sickened him. It was unreasonable. He had had to kill or be killed, and Dubreuil was the man who misused Carrington and Vargas so inhumanly until they died. Yet there it was, and he found that he could do no more than read mechanically, scarcely retaining anything of significance. The squalor of his own conduct and of his enemies, all for the best of motives. The extreme violence of this morning, the physical and perhaps moral exhaustion, were obvious causes for his state, yet it was strange that he could not master his thinking mind and compel it to answer the question, what was he to do next? He posed the question again and again, and the only answer was that it was impossible to leave the hotel with a Frenchman waiting in the hall, that he must nevertheless get these documents and Diana clear, and that the Asclepia could be no sort of refuge once Johnson was back. A string of negatives, no more. He heard Diana return. She was talking, and for a moment he thought it must be Johnson, back before his time, perhaps warned by the traitor Peg. But then he realized that the other voice was Herapath's. He went towards her, door after door, and she met him in the dining room. Her face was anxious and downcast, and as soon as she saw him, she said,
"I'm so sorry, so very sorry, Stephen, darling, but Andrews was not there. He has gone back to Halifax in the cartel with nearly all the prisoners of war."
"Never mind it, my dear," said Stephen gently.
He felt an immense pity for her. He could hardly tell why.
"Herapath is with you?"
"In the drawing room."
"Were there any Frenchmen in the hall?"
"Yes, quite a crowd, laughing and talking, some in uniform, but neither Pontécanet nor Dubreuil."
They walked into the drawing room. Herapath greeted Stephen with a look of deep concern, but Stephen only gave him a vague how-d'ye-do and said he must write a note.
"There is a writing table in my room," said Diana, opening the door and pointing.
He stared stupidly at the paper for some moments and then wrote,
"Jack, I have been obliged to kill two Frenchmen here. There are other Frenchmen below, and I cannot get out. They tried to kill me this morning. I must get Diana out of here at any cost at all, and some papers and myself, if it can be done. Wogan will not do. Do not tell Herapath this, nor the Asclepia. Choate might find Diana a refuge, or Father Costello, who is to marry me. I am not myself. Jack, do what you can. The big porter might prove a friend."
"Mr. Herapath," he said, coming back, "might I beg you to give this to Captain Aubrey as soon as ever you can reach him? It is of the very last importance to me, or I should not trouble you."
"With all my heart," said Herapath.
They were alone, and Diana moved about the room, lighting candles, drawing curtains. She looked at him from time to time and said,
"My God, Stephen, I have never seen you look so down, or low, or such a wretched colour. Have you had anything to eat today?"
"Not a thing," he said, trying to smile.
"I shall order a meal at once, and while it is coming, lie on my bed and have a drink. You look as if you could do with it. I shall have one too."
He did as he was told. His head was furiously painful now, but he said,
"No food."
"You do not like to see me drinking, do you?"
she said, pouring out the bourbon.
"No," said he. "You are a fool to your complexion, Villiers."
"Is whisky bad for it?"
"Spirits harden tissues, sure. That is a fact."
"I only drink any when I am excited, as I am now, or when I am low. Still, as I have been low ever since I came here, I dare say I must have swallowed gallons. But I will not be low with you, Stephen."
A long silence, and she went on.
"Do you remember, years and years ago, you asked me whether I had read Chaucer, and I said, 'Filthy old Chaucer,' and you abused me for it. Well, at least he did say, 'In woman, venolent is no defence. Thus knoweth lechers by experience.'"
"Diana," he said abruptly, "do you know anyone in America? Have you any sure friend that you can trust? that you can run to?"
"No," she said, surprised. "Not a single soul. How could I, in my position? Why do you ask?"
"You were so kind as to write me a letter yesterday. A very, very kind letter."
"Yes?"
"It never reached me. I found it on Johnson's desk, next to your diamonds."
"Oh, my God," she said, quite deadly pale.
"Clearly we must be away before he returns," said Stephen. "I have sent to Jack to see what he can do. If he can do nothing, why, there are other possibilities."
Maybe there were, but what were they, apart from a wild flight in the dark? His mind could not, or would not, grapple with the problem hard and tight. Clear, prolonged, incisive thought was beyond his power.
"I don't care," she said, taking his hand. "I don't mind, so long as you are there."